All right, we are going to finish John chapter 8 tonight and perhaps get into chapter 7, the chapter, we don't want to go backwards, do we? Chapter 9, it may seem at times that we are going backwards, but we'll get into chapter 9 perhaps a little bit tonight, but for sure finish chapter 8. We left off last week at about verse 56 or so. And let's just start there at verse 56. And the last few verses here, of course, are really very powerful verses. Perhaps the strongest affirmation of the deity of Christ that we have in the book of John. And let's not forget that the book of John, really, the theme of the book, or maybe we should just say that what John was really trying to accomplish in the parts of the life of Christ that he reveals is to emphasize the deity of Christ. We saw that from the very beginning. And so it means a lot to say that this passage is probably, again, the greatest affirmation of that in the entire book. And so it's really a powerful few verses that we have here. So verse 56 begins, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day." And I think we left off talking about that just a little bit. But you notice again, it's interesting that he starts like that. Verse 56, "Your father Abraham." You remember back in verse 39, where we talked about that a little bit last week. It says, "They answered him, Abraham is our father. And Jesus said to them, if you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did." So he really basically there denies that they're Abraham's children. But as we pointed out before, there's two things going on there. Jesus was never trying to deny that they were the physical descendants of Abraham. Obviously, they were. And I think in a few different places, he acknowledges that even here in John chapter 8. So what he is denying is that they're the spiritual seed or offspring of Abraham. And that, of course, is the most important thing. We are the spiritual offspring of Abraham. And there are many passages that talk about that. One popular passage is Galatians chapter 3. Turn over there just for a second and notice what towards the end of that chapter, what Paul says there, beginning at verse 27, he says, "For as many of you who have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. And there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise." And so those of us who have been baptized into Christ, then we are the spiritual offspring of Abraham. And what Jesus denied in chapter 8 of John is that that's exactly what the Jews were not, at least these Jews who he is dealing with. They were the physical descendants of Abraham, but they were not the spiritual descendants. To have that, you have to have the kind of faith that Abraham had. Again, in this dispensation, that is demonstrated by one's obedience to the gospel of Christ. But they, of course, were rejecting the words of Christ. They were rejecting him as a whole. And so in acting in ways that did not demonstrate any relationship to Abraham at all. But after saying, you know, if you were the children of Abraham, you would do what he did. But now he starts up this verse acknowledging that from a physical standpoint, I understand that you are the children of Abraham. So he refers to Abraham as their father. But notice he says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day." And that just points to the great faith that Abraham had, that God made certain promises about this particular day. When he says my day, he wasn't speaking of himself specifically. Abraham didn't know Jesus, of course, but speaking of the day of the Messiah, Abraham would think of the day of his offspring, the offspring that was promised to him, the seed through whom all the families of the earth would be blessed. When God made those promises to Abraham, he demonstrated a great deal of faith and believed. Look over. Let's go all the way back to Genesis chapter 15. And you probably are or should be familiar with these Abrahamic promises. Genesis chapter 15 and at verse 1 it says, "And after these things the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield, and your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless?" And we don't have to read all of this, but Abraham here in Genesis chapter 15 is probably over 80 years old at this particular time, and he doesn't have any children yet. And yet God has made promises to him already, way back in chapter 12, with regard to his descendants. But to save time, drop down verse 4, I guess, says, "And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, this man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look towards heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be." Now that is, you know, you just think about that kind of promise that God is making to a man who is in his 80s, who doesn't have any children. His wife is barren, and he takes him outside and says, see the stars? That's how many offspring you're going to have. And how does Abraham respond to that? Verse 6 says, "And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness." And so he was he had a great deal of faith. And we read of this sort of thing throughout these chapters in Genesis, over in chapter 17. And at verse 1, it says, "And when Abram was 99 years old," so now he's almost 100, and he's 99 years old, "the Lord appeared to him and said to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, that I may make a covenant between me and you and multiply you greatly. Abraham fell on his face, and God said to him, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram." And Abram means exalted father. But this is where he changes his name. From Abram, he says, "but your name shall be called Abraham, for I have made you a father of a multitude of nations." So from Abram, exalted father, to Abraham, a father of a multitude, is what Abraham means. And notice there, he says, "I have made you." And the tense is very important there. Not "I'm going to make you," but "I have made you a father of a multitude of nations." So it's already a done deal, even though still he's 90 years old and he hasn't had any children at this point, no children by Sarah. She continues to be barren. And yet God says, "I have made you a father of many nations." And so again, a great promise. And then over in chapter 22, we have the wonderful chapter where, of course, Abraham now, Isaac, of course, has been born, and now he's commanded to offer up Isaac as a burnt offering. And we're all familiar with that, how that he showed great faith and doing that. And down at verse 15 then, after having been willing to offer up Isaac, the angel of the Lord, of course, stopped him, but he was willing to do that. So the angel of the Lord called to Abram, verse 15, a second time from heaven, and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. And I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." And I still like, you know, I'm reading from the ESV for years, having the King James. I still like it, the idea of the seed. In your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And Abraham understood what he was talking about. Now, one of the things we should probably point out in all of this is, I think you probably know that in all of these conversations that God has with his people, special men like Abraham, we certainly don't have all that he said to these men. It's just like with the sermons of Paul. You read about the sermons that Paul preached in the book of Acts. I think you probably know we don't have those sermons in their entirety. They're just summarized for us. And the highlights and the important things that were said, we have. And that's the case with these conversations with Abraham. God certainly said more to Abraham than we're privy to. But Abraham, by these promises that he made, Abraham knew when he talked about his seed, his offspring, he knew he was talking about the fact that the earth, the world would be blessed through this offspring. And Abraham, by faith, believed it, and he looked forward to that time arriving. And of course, again, that really, when God said these things to Abraham, he was preaching the gospel to Abraham. Remember over in Galatians, we were over in Galatians 3 a moment ago. Turn back over there just for a second, very quickly. In the earlier part of that chapter, we're at the very end a few moments ago, but earlier in that chapter, Galatians chapter 3 and at verse 8, I believe it is. Galatians 3 and at verse 8. It says, and the scriptures, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham. So isn't that interesting? That really, we talk about the first gospel sermons preached Acts chapter 2. Yes, technically it was. But God preached the gospel to Abraham. And when did he do that? It says that he preached the gospel to Abraham, saying, in you shall all the nations be blessed. We just read that, didn't we? In you. That meant in his seed, in his offspring, all the families of the earth would be blessed. And of course, and so again, the point of it is, Abraham was looking forward to that. And that's the point that Jesus is making over here in John chapter 8. When he speaks to these Jews, your father rejoiced that he would see my day. By faith, he had a great deal of hope. But now watch, not only did he rejoice that he wanted to see that day, but then it goes on to actually say that he saw it. He says he saw it and was glad. Now, a lot of people take that and they, in my estimation, they kind of lessen the importance of that by saying Abraham saw the day of Jesus by faith. And that's true. And in fact, in Hebrews chapter 11, the great chapter on faith, Hebrews chapter 11, and at verse 13, about all of these great faithful characters that the Hebrews writer outlines for us here in Hebrews chapter 11, this hall of fame of the faithful, at verse 13, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on earth. So these great people of faith, they saw these promises afar. And there's a sense in which that was true with regard to Abraham way back in his day. That he saw these things coming about afar. He saw them by faith. But the fact of the matter is, he literally saw them. He literally saw the day of Jesus. And the reason for that, of course, is because Jesus, or Abraham rather, he didn't just cease to exist when he died, did he? He continued to live. Remember in Matthew chapter 22? Turn over there. Matthew chapter 22, and this is an occasion when Jesus is on this occasion dealing with the Sadducees. And at verse 23, Matthew chapter 22, it says, the same day the Sadducees came to him who say that there is no resurrection, and they asked him a question, saying, Teacher, Moses said if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, having no offspring, left his wife to his brother. So too the second and the third down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her. Well, Jesus answered them, said, you are wrong, because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry or are given to marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and of Jacob. I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. Now, can you remember where that was said? Who can remember? Where do you remember hearing God saying, I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, God of Jacob? Exodus, yes. Huh? That's exactly right. Moses at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3 is where it was. And what's amazing about that whole thing is, now some of this is, some would dispute this. I think the majority of scholars would agree with what I'm about to say. But you remember in that burning bush, God, of course, spoke to the Lord. Moses. Who actually spoke out of the burning bush? You remember? The angel of the Lord. And it's always been my conviction that is referring. The angel of the Lord in the Old Testament is the pre-incarnate Christ. That it is, when you do a study of the angel of the Lord, it's hard to come to any other conclusion than that. And we don't have time to study that tonight, of course, but when you look at that, the angel of the Lord, you know it's clear in the Old Testament that the angel of the Lord is not the Father. There are passages where they appear together and they're speaking to each other. But not only that, we know the angel of the Lord is divine. And so who is it? Most scholars believe, and I agree with them, and have always taken the position that that's Christ before his incarnation. And so it was, you know, back then you wouldn't call him Jesus, but it was the Word before he was made flesh speaking to Moses, saying, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And so we want to keep that in mind a little bit, because that passage in Exodus chapter 3 comes to play again in these next few verses. But the point of it here is, when God said that to Moses, I mean, Abraham's day had come and gone. He had died, obviously, by Exodus chapter 3. And yet God says, I am the God of Abraham. And Jesus goes on to make the point to the Sadducees, who denied the resurrection, that God is the God of what? Of the living. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. Which tells you Abraham is very much alive. And so when Jesus came on the scene, and during his personal ministry and all of that, the day of the Messiah, Abraham literally saw that. And that, I believe, is the point that Jesus is making to these Pharisees and to the leading Jews. I don't believe he's only saying, although it would be true that Abraham saw the day of Jesus by faith when he was actually living here and received those promises. I believe Jesus is really literally saying, Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he has seen it and was glad because he is very much alive. But now, watch. The Jews, of course, get all worked up over that. At verse 57 says, so the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? Well, they missed the point again, didn't they? They keep doing, at least in most of our translations, Jesus didn't say anything about seeing Abraham. But that's what they say. Now, it should be pointed out here that where it says, have you seen Jesus? There are a few manuscripts that say, has Abraham seen you? But that's not reflected in, anybody have a translation that says that? It's reflected in a few translations, but uh, not too many, which tells you that that may have appeared in a few manuscripts, but in this case, it's very few. And the large amount of manuscripts read like that. And the point is that these Jews just missed the point. They just misunderstood the words of Jesus again, though Jesus would have said, of course, and could have said, yes, I have seen Abraham. And so, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. 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 Yeah, there's no question about that. And even the Pharisees themselves wouldn't have much problem with it. The Sadducees are the ones who denied that. But the point of it is, Jesus was very much alive at that particular point during his ministry. But again, they miss all of that. I mean, what did he say so far? All he said about Abraham is he rejoiced to see my day. And they come back and say, well, you're not even 50 years old. Have you seen it? Jesus could have said, did I say I've seen Jesus? But now, of course, Jesus could have said, yes, I have seen Jesus. And now that's kind of the point that he begins to make, but in a lot deeper way. But notice he says to them then at verse 58, truly, truly, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. And that is really the affirmation that I was talking about a few moments ago of his deity. It is a powerful affirmation, and they caught it right away. And now just look at the language now. Truly, I say unto you that before Abraham was. Again, some translation adds the word born there. The Greek word basically means before Abraham came to be or came into existence. And it's in the aorist tense. It's denoting a specific time when Abraham came into being. So there was a moment when Abraham did not exist, and then the moment came when he did exist, that he came into being. Abraham was. And so that's he's pointing to his birth, obviously, and that's why a few translations throw in the word born there. But there was a moment in time when Abraham came to be. There was never a moment in time when the Son of God came to be. Now, I'm not talking about his flesh, his incarnation. I'm talking about as a being, there has never been a time when he came into being. Why? Because what? He's eternal. He's eternal. And almost all Greek scholars are unanimous in the fact that this is, by the language that Jesus uses here, Jesus is pointing to eternal existence. Now he simply uses the word, I am. I am. But the Greek formation of all of that points to not just exist. He's basically saying Abraham came into being and I existed before that. And that is a powerful part of that. But if you were the little Greek boy listening to what Jesus was saying, you would know that he was pointing to eternal existence. He is saying Abraham came into being at a specific time. I have always been. And that's powerful stuff. Coming from Jesus. And again, these Jews, right away, they understood exactly what he was claiming. For Jesus to say, I have always been, what is he declaring? He's God. I mean, you can't affirm or claim deity any more than that. There's only one who has been in existence eternally, the one we call God. We know that Godhead is made up of three persons. But God is eternal. Nothing else is eternal but God. God alone. And Jesus here is claiming eternal existence. Yeah, go ahead, Greg. Yes. Exactly right. Exodus 3, verse 14, is, you remember what Greg is talking about, where the where Moses was a little bit fearful about going on this great mission that God was choosing him to go on. And when I get to the people, what should I say to them? Who should I tell them is sending me? And God said, you tell them, I am, is sending you. And that was, and in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible in the Septuagint, it's the exact words that Jesus uses here. Ego, eimi is the Greek phrase. And that's exactly what is used back in Exodus 3 at verse 14. And remember now, you have to study this out for your own self, but back then in Exodus chapter 3, that is who we know as Jesus speaking to Moses, saying, you tell him I am sent you. And now here, Jesus says to this Jewish audience, Abraham was, but I am. And there's no question in my mind, and most scholars would conclude this, that he was without doubt. He uses the word I am a lot, the words I am, ego, eimi, several times. I am the light. I am the good shepherd. And he's not always referencing that. But here, he is. He doesn't say, I am anything. Just, I am. And he is referring back to that name. And again, the Jews knew that immediately. Yeah, go ahead, Dale.
I was looking back, I was running reference back to Exodus 13, where it talks about the Lord, was, as he guided the people out of Egypt for a cloud.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's several passages that indicate, you know, he is in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I believe it is, where he is referenced as being the rock. And back in the book of Genesis, that is mentioned as the rock that followed them, that helped them. And there may be a specific, nothing comes to my mind exactly with that, but there's several indications of that. That Jesus was there. He was in the wilderness with the Israelites. So there's no question about the pre-existence of Christ. But it's not too often that it's stated in these terms, with this terminology, that's so clear. And again, when we read that, you would read this, as American and English-speaking people living here in the 21st century. We may not think of all of that. And Greg, yeah, I mean, you know, we're familiar. You've studied through Exodus chapter 14 and other passages, so you can make the connection easily. But in the Jew, they had, of course, the Hebrew text. And they knew that holy name that was of Yahweh, I am. And so they right away, and look at verse 59 then. So they picked up stones to throw at him. Why they want to do that? Because he was claiming to be God. And they knew it. And they right away thought, this is blasphemy. And they wanted to kill him. So they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. But if you ever wanted to see evidence of the deity of Christ, you just remember that terminology. Abraham was, but I am. Not only a reference to that divine name back in Genesis chapter, Exodus chapter 3, but the very wording of it again points to eternal existence. Jesus, as God, was without beginning and without end. He has always existed. And of course, you know, there's several other passages that we read. You remember in both John chapter 1 that we've seen and Colossians chapter 1, where Jesus has created all things. All things have been created by him. Well, that makes sense when you realize that he was before the beginning, that he is God. He is eternal. And now there's a whole lot of people in the religious world today who would want to pick up stones and throw at Jesus, because there's Jehovah Witnesses and others who deny the deity of Christ. In fact, the Jehovah Witness in their New World's Translation I can't remember exactly how they word it there. I think they have in their translation, I have been, instead of I am, because at least I'm convinced they realize the connection between I am here in the I am of Exodus 3:14. They don't like that at all. So in their Bible, they translated Jesus saying, Abraham was and I have been. and no justification for that kind of translation of it, but they do that a lot in their Bible. They just translate it the way they want to fit their theology. But they deny the deity of Christ. Remember, they think he's just Michael the archangel. But this language, clearly, Jesus affirmed his deity. All right, any questions about that? That wraps up chapter 8. Any questions about that? All right. Now, we get into chapter 9 then. And in chapter 9, there is probably some space of time that goes by between 8 and 9. That is debatable. This is what we know for sure. Between chapter 7 and chapter 9, at least 2 months, between a month or two, has passed. We know that for sure. And the reason we know that is because in chapter 10, look at chapter 10, and everybody agrees there is no space of time between chapter 9 and 10. When we get to chapter 10 at verse 1, that picks up the discourse right from the end of chapter 9. But in chapter 10 at verse 22, it says, and at that time, the feast of dedication took place at Jerusalem. So that's the time period now in chapters 9 and 10. It's about the time of the feast of dedication. That feast of dedication took place on the Jewish calendar on the ninth month. But remember chapter 7, what was the feast that we kept dealing with? Remember? That's right, the Feast of Tabernacles. That took place on the Jewish calendar in the seventh month. So somehow between chapter 7 and now chapter 9, 2 months have passed. Between a month and two. It's kind of hard to tell. The Jewish calendar overlaps our months and things. But between a month and two has passed. And a lot of times when we go through these Gospels and through these narratives, we kind of know, oh, here's this has happened. You've heard me say it in some of our studies. Well, now here we know that some time has passed. It's kind of hard in this context to know exactly when that took place between chapter 7 and chapter 9, but we know it took place because of those feasts. And so here, a lot of people believe, a lot of commentaries believe that it happened right here. That verse 1 of chapter 9 isn't picking up right away from the end of chapter 8, but a month or two has actually passed. So anyway, he says, and as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And so that's kind of an odd question, isn't it? From our perspective, we think, well, why did they ask him that? There's been some who believe that the disciples adopted the transmigration theory, which is one soul leaving at death, the soul leaves one body and goes into another. And there's no, you know, that was a strong belief among people, but there's no evidence that not only the disciples, but the Jews even as a whole ever adopted that kind of theory. What's really going on is that the disciples are just thinking illogically here. And the reason they're thinking illogically is because they have adopted the idea that somehow physical infirmities are due to personal sin. And so that's sort of getting them off track here, is why they ask this question. There are a lot of people who believe that all physical infirmities can be traced back to personal sin. Well, does sin sometimes cause some physical problems? Yeah, and there's no doubt. Romans chapter 1, verse 27 is one passage that comes to mind right away when Paul is talking about homosexuality and how that those who were practicing that were reaping the consequences of that in their bodies. some kind of sexually transmitted disease was tearing them up. They didn't have the kind of medication and stuff that we have today, and doctors and things. And they were, you know, it was really hurting them. And that was because of the sin that they were practicing. So there's no question that that is true. And we all know that to be the case. In a lot of different ways, sin can hurt and destroy the body. But it's different to say that sometimes sin can have a physical effect upon the body, to go from that to say that every time someone has a physical infirmity, it's due to his personal sin. That the Bible never teaches. And we know that's not the case. But they kind of logically, they just assumed that. And then they fell into what is sometimes called the either-or fallacy. They concluded, okay, when you have some kind of physical infirmity, it's someone has sinned physically. And so now their conclusion was it either has to be this man who was born in sin, or it wasn't him, it had to be his parents. It had to be either or. They didn't have any third option for that. And as we'll see, because I'll be gone next week, but the week after that, we'll see that there is another option. They didn't have to take the either or. Fact of the matter is, this man being born blind had nothing to do with him sinning or his parents sinning. It was a third situation. But they had this either or fallacy that they bought into. And so now they ask Jesus, here's a man, he's born blind. Who has sinned? Did he sin or was it his parents? And there were some rabbis who believed that you could sin in the womb. You know, the evidence of that is the Esau and Jacob struggling together in the womb. And they actually, these rabbis who take that position, actually teach that Esau was guilty of attempted murder. he was trying to kill Jacob. And it's just nonsense, of course, but there's been religious silliness going all the way back that far. But the truth is, it wasn't the sin of this man or his parents. It was something else, and we'll talk about that something else next time we meet.